You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Next Picture Show listeners. Are you in Chicago? Are you a little tired of listening to our disembodied voices and ready to actually see those voices come out of our faces? If so, you should come see us record live at the Chicago Podcast Festival on November 19th. We'll be at the Steppenwolf 1700 Theater, which is a fairly small, intimate venue, at 10 p.m. on Saturday night. And we'll be doubled up with the folks from the Booth One podcast, so you get twice as much podcasting action for your dollar. Tickets are available at chicagopodcastfestival.org. We'll be trying a different, livelier format and trying to get you involved, too. So we hope to see you there.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a current release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias,
Keith Phipps.
Here in the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we hit the road, Jack, and we come back with a lot of thoughts about The Other America, the one where indie movie characters go to express their loneliness and rootlessness and to find themselves in a place far away from home. As Simon and Garfunkel once sang, we've all come to look for America, and we're looking for it in a pair of road movies about underprivileged outsiders and the dreams that keep them hustling from place to place. Genevieve, you know what I'm talking about, right? You've heard the chimes at midnight.
Yes, and I know that we who steal do so at midnight, but we who discuss films professionally want to talk about where that chimes reference came from and why it's significant to the 1991 movie My Own Private Idaho. Writer-director Gus Van Sant had already had a major breakthrough in 1989 with Drugstore Cowboy when he made My Own Private Idaho, an indie road movie that's a little bit punk, a little bit western, a little bit surrealist fantasy, and a whole lot road movie. Van Sant's story takes an episodic look at two street hustlers, the narcoleptic Mike, played by River Phoenix, and the slumming rich boy Scott, played by Keanu Reeves at the beginning of his career. They both have significant family problems, and they eventually take to the road to try to solve Mike's issues, while Scott's wait for him at home. The troubled home lives, the dreamy quality of the story, and Mike's desperate crush on Scott all came to mind when we saw American Honey, the new road movie from Andrea Arnold, the British director of Fish Tank and Red Road. In Arnold's movie, a young Texas woman named Star, played by first-time actress Sasha Lane, lets herself get seduced into joining a group of magazine subscription sellers who travel from town to town in a crowded van. It's an escape of sorts, but it comes with plenty of its own problems, linked both to life on the road and to the people managing the crew.
Both films literally take us for a ride, in a series of chapters that don't always connect, but that lead to some thoughts about growing up, moving on, and claiming some kind of personal identity. Van Sant's movie is a little more beholden to Shakespeare, and Arnold's is a little more influenced by rap, but both films trade in cultural connections and expectations, and then the adaptability and energy of young people trying to survive. There's not another road anywhere that looks exactly like these two roads, so we're going to take a ride down them together.
Hey, Mike, how long have I been here on this street, on this crusade?
Oh, well, I came back to town around 3.5 years ago, and that's when I met you, so it's been
3 years, Mike.
Yeah, almost 4 years. That's a long time.
What I'm getting at, Mike, is that we're still alive.
Yeah, well, that's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly obvious. They can drop a big old bomb in this city, you know what we would do?
Take shelter.
My Own Private Idaho was one of those long-tail projects that kicked around in its creator's head for a long time in a lot of different shapes and sizes before it finally made it to the screen in the form we saw in 1991. Gus Van Sant was a commercial director, making his own film experiments on the side when he directed his debut, 1986's Malanoche, about a gay store clerk and his crush on a younger Mexican man. As an openly gay filmmaker, Van Sant was particularly interested in gay stories and in young men on the fringes of society. By the time he made that film, he was already developing My Own Private Idaho as a mishmash of multiple ideas he'd had, one based on Shakespeare, about a street hustler based on Prince Hal and Henry IV, one about two hustlers on a journey of discovery, and a third about a young hustler being kept by an older German man. You can see in the final script how these stories merged into something episodic with elements of all three previous stories. But in 1991, gay life and street life weren't remotely close to mainstream culture, and Van Sant couldn't get anyone interested in funding the project until he had a major hit with his second film, Drugstore Cowboy. At that point, New Line Cinema took an interest in his work. But his backers wanted him to cut the Shakespeare elements and the surrealism out of My Own Private Idaho and make it into a much more conventional road movie. Van Sant stuck to his guns, given that he'd already repeatedly revised the script, and we're left with something fairly unique, a dreamy picture that mirrors the fractured state of mind of the protagonist, who passes out in stressful situations and loses time both to narcolepsy and to the dreams that consume him when he's out. There are a lot of legends around My Own Private Idaho, about how Keanu Reeves drove 2,000 miles on a motorcycle to deliver the script to River Phoenix, whose agent didn't want him to see it, or about how the two of them hung out with hustlers on the streets of Portland to research the role, with Phoenix taking drugs and experimenting with gay sex, while Reeves took a much more distanced approach. There are a lot of fun, strange stories about how Van Sant and Phoenix badgered director William Reichert into taking the role of Bob, the indigent Falstaff character who lords over the homeless community in Portland. But all the stories pale in comparison to the actual movie, which veers in and out of reality, hops to a different country, and operates both as a stagey, removed update of Shakespeare and as a street docudrama where talking head characters tell their worst street stories directly to the camera. Above all, though, it's about the journey Mike and Scott take looking for Mike's mother, each of them having a different agenda in mind. So what do you guys make of My Own Private Idaho? What were your experiences with it?
I mean, I think it's extraordinary. I mean, I think it holds up really well, but in the context of the time, there was really nothing quite like it. I mean, we had gay cinema. It was sort of, when did Poison come out?
Poison was around the, it was 1990, I believe.
Right around the same time. I mean, there wasn't a lot of it, and certainly not at this level, and it was just a trip into a different world, and there was a poetry to the filmmaking that was new. Yeah, and River Phoenix's performance is really kind of what gets to me that then and now. You know, his death certainly casts a different light on the movie, but even without it, the idea of him as being this extraordinarily vulnerable person. I mean, I kind of compare him to like a turtle without a shell. You know, he has narcolepsy, he gets stressed out and he falls asleep. And wherever he lands, anybody can do anything to him. And Scott is somebody who offers him a certain amount of protection. But when he goes away, then what has he got? You know, I mean, he's just really, you talk about characters on the fringes. I mean, he's right there. He's right on the precipice. And I just feel like his vulnerability and his desire are so raw. I just find the film, the tenderness of the film, the personal nature of the film, the texture of the film, it really gets to me. I love it so much.
Yeah, I think it's terrific too. And you know, I do remember when it came out and how it was kind of subversive that River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves were stars, but also, you know, teen idols to a certain degree at the time were cast in this film. It got a lot of attention. It probably got a lot more viewers than would have seen it otherwise. Probably viewers like my high school friends and I who watched it on VHS at some point and might not have seen it otherwise. And it was completely eye-opening. Like, I think this is maybe a certain degree of naivete on my part as a teenager, but this whole world of street hustling, of being gay and turning tricks and that being like a world unto itself was something I'd never seen before.
Yeah, there's actually a great story about how, I mean, this was from Interview Magazine. River Phoenix apparently, right before they shot the sex scene with Udo Kier, River Phoenix apparently kind of verbally poked Keanu Reeves and said, you know, you've got 10 million fans who are going to pause on this scene a lot. And it apparently really unnerved Keanu Reeves and really messed with the dynamics of the scene. And Gus Van Sant, like, took River Phoenix to the woodshed afterwards and like really yelled at him about just basically messing with Reeves' head. But yeah, I mean, these guys just had such a reputation at the time. And they were certainly aware that it was potentially career danger to get into this film. But they were also both young and at a point in their lives where they wanted to do dangerous stuff. And they both felt that this was exciting, I guess. Exciting and dangerous and out on the edge. Genevieve, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to like out myself as being very ignorant about my own Private Idaho going into it. This movie came out when I was far too young to like have it on my radar, and I really only knew it by reputation. Like, I knew it by name, and River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves are street hustlers, and that's like kind of, that's where my knowledge of the movie ended, and I had no frame of reference for this abstracted style that I was getting into with this movie. And I kind of wish I had before I started watching it, because I was really thrown for the first probably third of this movie, just trying to kind of get on its wavelength. And once I did, like, oh, I'm seeing like kind of a borderline experimental movie here, and in a lot of ways it was kind of a little easier to just like settle in for the ride. But there was a lot of like mental resistance of trying to place a narrative onto this movie that really does not invite a traditional narrative framework in a lot of ways.
I think it helps if someone taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, it's based in part on Henry IV.
Yes.
That's a huge help.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is, like, I did know that there was a Shakespearean element to it going in, but it's confusing. Like, it's in, I guess we can talk about the Shakespearean element now. It's integrated in a very odd way, in that it just kind of like becomes a flat out Shakespearean adaptation for maybe 20 minutes and then it stops, you know. Like, Scott and Bob are still Prince Hal and Falstaff, you know, kind of vaguely, but like there's a segment there where they are basically speaking Shakespearean language. Is it direct quote from the text? I'm looking at you, Keith.
Some of it's modified. The credit in the closing credits is additional dialogue by William Shakespeare, yeah, which is one of the most amusing. But I mean, some of it is close to it and then not quite.
It's interesting the way it's like kind of plopped in there and then sort of abandoned. But I really liked that scene, and I'm still processing this film, guys. Help me.
Was this the first time you'd seen it?
Yes.
I mean, if nothing else, I've got to imagine that seeing it today is just a really different experience, because the film was so celebrated and got so much attention for the campfire scene, mm-hmm, where Keanu Reeves says, you know, men can't love each other, and River Phoenix says, yes, they can. And I mean, that was really out there at the time. There are a lot of gay kids who watched that and who came to Van Sant like over the course of the next couple of decades and said, you know, that made me come out, that changed, mm-hmm, my life, because it was something that they had literally never seen in media before.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I could tell watching that, like, oh, like this was probably a pretty quintessential moment in gay cinema. And I was watching this movie with my roommate who is gay, and we were fairly far into it before he was like, wait, is this a gay movie? and like, he is a pretty engaged culture consumer, but it was like not on his radar as a gay man. And he's younger, he's in his like 20s.
He's the age of the characters.
Yeah, exactly. So I was kind of struck by the way that, you know, this thing that was clearly pointed and a little subversive in its time, it maybe kind of just faded out of the consciousness of a younger generation of gay men.
Well, but I mean, I think there is a little bit of distance that Scott is responsible for in that, mm-hmm, scene, though. I mean, that he is putting up this wall that Mike is trying to traverse unsuccessfully, though they do have, I think, there is a moment of intimacy there that is moving in its own right.
But, oh, I think that scene is
it's
wonderful.
So beautiful.
Yeah.
That's the scene of the movie, I think, really. And it just, mm-hmm,
all the stylistic flourishes, just the camera holding on them for that long scene of dialogue.
That's one of those. I know you hate extratextual, Scott, but Phoenix wrote that scene. Van Sant had it as a really brief sort of aside. It was never meant to be a big deal.
Yeah, I think I read that. Yeah.
Yeah. And Phoenix said, you know, this needs to be fleshed out. He needs to tell you who he is. And he wrote the whole scene, and that scene makes the movie.
I'd like to talk with you. I mean, I'd like to really talk with you. I mean, we're talking right now, but, you know, I don't know. I don't feel like I can be. I don't feel like I can be close to you. I mean, we're close. Right now, we're close, but, I mean, you know.
How close? I mean,
I don't know. Whatever.
What?
What do I mean to you?
What do you mean to me? Mike, you're my best friend.
I know, man. I know I'm your friend. We're good friends, and it's good to be, you know, good friends. That's a good thing.
So?
So I just... That's okay. We can be friends. Only have sex with a guy for money. Yeah, I know. And two guys can't love each other. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, I could love someone even if I, you know, wasn't paid for it.
Not to dwell on it, because we could just spend the whole podcast, but just watching this, I just sort of, you know, you mourn for the performances you didn't get from River Phoenix. Yeah, it's just a remarkable
actor. He was still, I mean, he was still, the rawness of him as a talent was does not hurt this film in any way, but he's somebody who could have developed into an even greater actor than he shows in this movie. Though, I don't know, I really love him in Dogfight and Running on Empty. He was good.
He seems a little less comfortable with the Shakespearean dialogue than others.
Well, first of all, he had no Shakespearean experience, right, which Reeves did have. But second of all, he was uncomfortable with it in the movie. Like, he didn't think it belonged. He actually argued with Van Sant about it. He was really adamant that there should be a really strong stylistic divide between the Shakespeare stuff and what he called his docudrama stuff. He felt that those things needed to be stylistically separated. I'm not sure why, like, to let audiences know, okay, now we're back in whatever passes for reality in this film. I mean, watching this film, I don't mourn for him as an actor nearly as much as I mourn for him as a writer, as a, like, a potential writer, director, creator. Like, he showed a lot of talent here for creating a character and for devoting himself to his craft. On the other hand, he was apparently hugely methody in a way that was not physically healthy, given some of the things that he did.
I would also credit Van Sant for setting a whole lot of context for scenes like the campfire scene to come through. All this business with his home movie footage that we're flashing back to that may or may not be, you know, real, I guess, or remembered precisely. There's a context that Van Sant is setting up. The other point about the film, generally about the way to watch it and take it in, is My Own Private Idaho is a good example of the advantages of the road movie as a genre, because the idea of a road movie is you can travel to a lot of different places and a lot of random things can happen, and you just get moments and you get little flourishes. I mean, you talked about, like, this sex scenes in the movie, you know, the idea to do them all in these sort of frozen tableaus. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a flourish. Or you can have individual scenes like, you know, Mike role playing as a Dutch cleaning
scrubber boy.
Right. Right. Scrubber boy. And just that whole scene feels like it's, you know, lifted from a David Lynch movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. There's so much David Lynch in this
really
film.
There really is. And Grace Zabriskie is in this one, too.
Grace Zabriskie. And the sequence with Udo Kier doing his German cabaret act, which apparently he actually did German cabaret. And that was a song that he did in German cabaret. And they just stuck it in the
writing
movie.
Credit for it, too.
He originally did it with a blue flashlight. And Van Sant said, this looks too much like Blue Velvet. We can't do this. But it's made
so
me
good with the giant lamp, though. It makes it more unsettling.
I know, it's so creepy, but it made me go, I wonder how many, I can't remember how many films Udo Kier and David Lynch did together. And I looked it up and was like, is the IMDb missing like three or four projects? They've never worked together. Yeah. I mean, they've never, like, Lynch has never directed something with Kier in it. And that's so hard to believe.
He would fit right in.
He absolutely
He's
would.
He's the only person not in this Twin Peaks revival, apparently.
The that's only true. Person in the world.
Udo Kier or Jim Belushi. Let's go with Belushi.
I mean, I shot my cameo last week. I don't know about you guys.
Mine's coming up in 2 weeks.
Well, speaking to that, the way the film consists of all of these, like, different parts, the surreal dream sequences and the road sequences, the Shakespeare sequences, like the fuzzed out home movie stuff, the really artful thing, weird things like the magazine covers conversing with each other. Mm-hmm. Are there elements that you guys think work better than others or that don't work at all?
I kind of like the mishmash of it, to be honest. I think it really ends up making it a more interesting film. I never feel like I'm watching anything but a cohesive vision, despite all the different approaches. And part of it, I think, is that the performances and these characters carry it so well. And these two are very good in this film. I think culturally we decide every 5 years whether or not Keanu Reeves is a good actor or not.
There's a debate about that?
I like Keanu Reeves. I like him in this movie a lot too. And I think the two of them are just so open-hearted in this film, and they keep it all tied together. So that, to me, that's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, and it's just fun to be able to not know what the movie is going to do moment to moment, to suddenly be just whisked off to Italy. Here we go, we're in Italy. And then he meets somebody and they come back and he's a completely different person.
There's also this melancholy tone that no matter what it's doing stylistically, it's still all very much in the same key.
I want to talk a little about the road movie aspects of this. You guys are talking about it as like such a strong representation of a road movie, and I did not feel that.
It's not entirely, because so much of there's just a large chunk of action that's just in Portland.
Yeah, and it seems just more like kind of like hopping from place to place, whereas I consider road movies to be more about the journey. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Mike's narcolepsy, where, you know, he just shuts down and then wakes up in a new place, takes that element away from it. So I was kind of like struggling to reconcile this as a road movie in my brain because of that. It just didn't have, outside of the parts where they're like on the motorcycle, I didn't have that sense of like travel that I associate with road movies. But maybe that's not a fixed element of road movies. And
well, I don't think it is. I mean, I think a lot of people incorporate that. The Andrea Arnold in American Honey, there's an awful lot of focus specifically on the time spent on the road, because that's kind of when your characters get to know each other, mm-hmm. is when they're in transit. And that's kind of when you get that lonely road feeling. But I think part of the story here is that Mike's narcolepsy makes him miss the connective tissue, mm-hmm. that puts his world together, and he just experiences life as this series of vignettes. For me, it's a road movie because it has that sequence of he's at the house of his brother / father or whatever's going on there. He's in Portland. He's in Italy. I mean, the first trip to Portland is just sort of a spontaneous, oh, by the way, while you're passed out, we went to Portland. It has that structure of different stops along the way bring out different aspects of your personality, mm-hmm. and let you bond in different ways or separate in different ways. You're a different person in different places. That, to me, is more what a road movie is about.
So it's a more of an internalized road movie than an externalized one.
The road to self-realization.
Well, all road movies are roads to self-realization. Right. It's a big metaphor.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if you're asking the two key elements, it would be that as sort of the journey as metaphor for personal development, but also the way each new stop allows for a new episode to start. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to the quintessential one for me, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where every stop is like a little different movie into itself. And you get a little bit of that here too as well.
I mean, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that there are parts of the Shakespearean story here that I don't think work as well. Like, I really kind of love Keanu Reeves' arc as Prince Hal. I love where it ends up. Most of the interaction that he has personally with Bob as Falstaff, I really enjoy. But like the whole sequence with robbing the strangers, for me, is just like a big, loose, shaggy thing that goes on too long.
It's the most awkwardly staged. It's the one part where I thought to myself, I'm watching a low-budget movie.
Mm-hmm. But it also, I just ended up very confused about what we're supposed to make of it about the characters. Like, Keanu Reeves sets the whole thing up in order to tease Bob. And it seems like they spend an awful lot of time running around and screaming in a way that doesn't really communicate much. I mean, the after story where he's listening, I mean, which has such a Shakespearean feel, where he's like listening to Bob tell the story of what happened. That stuff is hilarious. But that, like, the actual buildup, I don't know. And then the magazine cover thing, I love so much.
I love the magazine cover
thing. Me too. Yeah, I think you can blame Shakespeare if the pacing's off in that one sequence you're talking about.
Blame Shakespeare.
Shakespeare gets everything wrong.
It probably wasn't even Shakespeare that wrote that sequence.
Christopher Marlowe.
Yeah, so you're getting on my favorite topic now. Oh boy, do I love the Shakespeare truthers.
How do you feel about turkey legs?
Brilliant bunch
world?
Of theorists.
We've kind of gotten into Reeves and Phoenix's performance. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on any of the other performances.
What Reichert, other performances?
Well, Reichert or Keir or Grace Zabriskie or like any of the young hustlers. I think some of those young hustlers, I kind of assume they're actually Portland hustlers. Mm-hmm. because the Mike character was built around a real person that Gus Van Sant knew, and then he originally wanted to have play that role. I kind of assume some of the, like, the young, unformed kids who are telling their worst street stories, like, I couldn't find any evidence one way or the other, but I kind of assume that those are real people.
It doesn't seem scripted, does
it? Yeah, and the best thing I could say about that is that there's not a huge separation between, you know, the professional actors and the amateurs in terms of style. Everything is well integrated in that when they're in that environment. We'll talk about this same issue later with American Honey, but that can be kind of an issue when you mix professional actors with non-professionals, is you just, it's noticeable who has chops and who doesn't. But I think it also speaks to Van Sant's interest in getting this scene right and getting the subculture right. In 1991, it was a revelation to see this entire community that we just would not see otherwise, of people who are gathering together in parks and in boarded up hotels, and this sort of transient community that was existing in parallel with the rest of Portland. I mean, that comes through especially starkly at the very end of the movie, during the dual funeral sequence, when both sets are just are at a complete remove in the same setting.
It's presented so sympathetically, too. I mean, these are characters that you had not really seen in movies at this point. If you had, maybe there's sort of the other that shows up to rob the good guys in a movie or something. It's not a world that was ever treated with this kind of empathy.
If I'm going to kind of poke a hole in the movie, though, I will say that the character of Scott is such a construct, mm-hmm. compared to how real Mike is, that when Scott undergoes this transformation, I guess, and returns to the fold, basically gives up being the slumming rich kid and becomes perhaps a future politician himself, whatever his journey to get there is not known to us. And I don't know if it resonates as strongly as it needs to make sense as anything more than just a statement, I guess, about what a rich kid slumming around might do. So I'm going to float that out as a flaw in the film.
Well, he fell in love.
He did, but he also fell in love with a farm girl.
Yeah, but I think if kind of this movie's whole driving force is like trying to find yourself in someone else, or like casting around for someone to be with, someone to connect with, I think it's pointed that when we do see Scott reemerge in this kind of new guise, it's with Carmela on his arm, you know, mm-hmm. and she's always there. It's like he's found his connection to the world he was running away from.
I'm with Scott, though. I mean, that falling in love sequence and the way it centers on that sex act that is just sort of a series of photographs, mm-hmm. that doesn't feel organic, and it doesn't feel emotional. It feels performative.
Yeah, let me say, like, I don't buy that. I'm just saying, like structurally, that's, I think, what they were going for. But I don't feel that relationship at all, just I think because of the way it is constructed in this very artificial framework.
It's just clear to me, too, that Van Sant's heart and the heart of the movie is entirely with Mike. I mean, mm-hmm. We haven't mentioned Malinoche, which is another, you know, road movie. Both Malinoche and Mike's part of My Own Private Idaho, they're both stories of unrequited desire. Malinoche about a Skid Row store clerk's obsession with a Mexican migrant worker. And now in Idaho is about a down-and-out sort of hustler's obsession with this preppy who has a small window of rebellion that is going to sort of close on him. But they're obviously personal stories for Van Sant, and you can feel that. That's so much the heart of the movie that it creates a certain imbalance between that part and the Keanu Reeves part that I think is actually, in a way, more disconcerting than the naturalism and the Shakespeare kind of trying mixing and matching.
I mean, I agree. It's just, for me, I hadn't seen this film since it came out. And what I remembered about it was, oh, Keanu Reeves is the bad guy. You know, Keanu Reeves is this basically two-faced character who betrays all of his friends. And rewatching it, I was just struck by the tenderness he shows Mike and how that tenderness seems to be authentic. And it feels a lot more authentic than his kind of turncoat ways at the end. But it's a very Shakespearean thing. I mean, look at Hamlet, to have a character say, you know, this may not be the way I feel, but I am going to perform this. I'm going to perform an act of villainy. I'm going to perform an act of heroism. I'm going to perform the role of the wastrel who displeases his father. And then when I'm tired of that, I will come back and perform the role of the dutiful son and surprise everybody. I mean, like, all of these things are about I'm putting on a mask. And I don't know if Shakespeare did that specifically because he was working with actors in theater and it was sort of an irony, or if it was just something that enabled the plot. But everything about what he does here does feel performative. Like, he's only performing it for himself. Maybe it's for his father. Maybe it's for the world. I think a flaw in the film for me is just we don't know what motivates him to perform all these things.
My question, the follow-up question was who's the real
Scott? Who's the audience?
Yeah. No, who is he?
I don't care who he is. I care who he's being, who he is for.
I mean, I think the story of Prince Hal is one's triumph and tragedy. The triumph is he ascends and becomes a great king, and maybe perhaps we can assume that's what's going to happen with Scott here. But there's something heroic about becoming a great towering figure, but at the same time, the tragedy is he leaves behind all these friendships. I mean, he leaves behind this community, and you know, he leaves behind, there's a part of himself behind as well. I mean Falstaff dies, at least, you know, is heading in that direction, and we see that here, and it's, you know, he leaves part of himself behind as well, where this life of freedom and lack of responsibility and just these easy friendships that he makes along the way. I mean, and the focus is so much on Mike here rather than Scott, but I think you kind of see that playing out in his background. I think he really does feel for Mike, but it comes a point in his life where he can't express those feelings or even really entertain those feelings anymore.
But why? Because if there was a sense that he was turned off by Mike's revelation around the campfire, if there was a feeling that he was repulsed or angered, that would make the character make so much sense. And that's not in the story at all.
I think it's just sort of the tragic inevitability of him growing up and assuming responsibility. And I think there's no way a kid from that background is going to live there forever.
And also the absence of a bridge between those two worlds too, right?
Mm. Well, speaking of all the focus being on Mike, we haven't focused, I think, nearly enough on Mike. I'm really curious what you guys make of the narcolepsy as a story device. I mean, apparently Van Sant put it in because he knew somebody who looked like he was always falling asleep. But that's a really specific choice to make for the story.
I think Scott laid out why it works so well really early on, which is this is a character who, even without narcolepsy, is vulnerable and just sort of blowing in the wind wherever life takes him, wherever fortune can take him, and to make that so concrete by giving him narcolepsy, I think was a really interesting choice. The end of this movie, I find completely devastating.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the vulnerability is the key, and the end of the movie is so devastating because he could not be in a more vulnerable spot. He's in the middle of nowhere. He's lying down on the road, and he has no friends, and he gets his shoes taken away from him and his his wallet probably, or no, his backpack is taken, right? And you know, and then another car comes and scans him for more stuff, right?
Well, we don't know. Picks him up and takes him away.
Right, it's completely open ended. This could be someone. This could be the person that saves his life.
Oh, okay, I misremembered. Yeah.
This could be the person that saves a life, or he could end up, in a ditch.
It could
somewhere.
Be Scott.
Yeah. Fan theory.
Oh, that. Wow. Okay. Did you seriously think that at any point?
I did, because of the way the figure picked Mike up in that cradling fashion. That is exactly how we see Scott pick him up.
Oh my God, you've blown the whole thing wide open. That never occurred to me.
I mean,
how does this fit into the Pixar universe?
Right.
Well, Tommy Westfall.
Well, that would be a really crazy thing to make.
Yeah,
ambiguous.
It is ambiguous and purposely so. But I do think that it is trying to make you think that that could be a possibility.
I don't think you're crazy, because it never occurred to me until 5 minutes before you said it. Like, if it could be anyone, maybe it could be Scott.
Oh my God, my mind is blown. I can't go on. We have to stop the podcast.
We do. Actually, I feel like going back and looking at the clip, it's like this is a Pruder film now.
I seriously think we might want to look at that. just because my first thought is, what if you can see that, from a distance, that he's blonde or something that?
I think it's coded in such a way that you'll never know.
No, because I was thinking it in the moment and studying it to see if it was for certain Scott, and there's no way to know for certain
so
that it is or isn't.
It's not
right
clear.
It's not like
Play,
he has a
everybody.
Shock of red hair or anything.
Well, okay. I said I couldn't go on, but I have to go on, because before we wrap up, I got to ask one thing. What the hell is up with the falling orgasm house?
I got an answer to this. It's a broken home, Tasha.
So you see, it's a metaphor.
My brain! I can't take any more of these revelations,
literally is a broken, it is a broken home. I mean, yes.
And you know what? Scott's in that home.
This is a young man who's...
That is ambiguous. You don't see through the window. You can't tell there's nobody in there.
You're talking about me.
I did too for a second.
You get salmon filming, swimming upstream to find their home. You get...
It's home movies?
A road stretching out to nowhere, but perhaps a home on the horizon. I mean, it's yeah, I don't think it's... I don't, we can crack this code, guys.
Broken home.
Why is it associated with orgasm?
I think that's just. I think it's just where his
your brain goes to its primal state in the midst of orgasm.
Let me tell you about the male orgasm, everybody. No, it's. So I think that's just where he. You know, he's just a drifter, and it's, you know, he's just off into space, and this is a nice little poetic image that Van Sant provides for us.
It's one type of fleeting pleasure being associated with a more permanent sort of pleasure.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I mean, I got the salmon thing, I got the road thing, I got the home movies thing, but you guys have changed this movie for me.
Orgasm House, rated R.
All right, well, we'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last episode. In our episode about Don't Breathe and Wait Until Dark, I brought up the confusion reviewers seem to have had over a plot point concerning Rocky, the female lead in Don't Breathe. Early on in the film, we see her with a young girl who she clearly wants to rescue from a bad family living situation. But it's unclear whether the little girl is Rocky's daughter or her little sister. One of our listeners wrote in to say that the girl should be Rocky's daughter because that makes the story better. Scott?
Ben writes, assuming the little girl in Rocky's house is her daughter, it's easy to imagine how early parenthood has impacted Rocky's life. It's clearly Rocky's obligation to her daughter that keeps this 20-something woman in a decrepit home with an abusive family, which she'd otherwise would have left several years ago. When the blind man says he will lock Rocky in his basement and force her to bear his child, she's being threatened with the nightmare version of the life she already lives, that of a captive mother. Much like Rosemary's Baby, Don't Breathe has turned a young woman's mundane anxieties about parenthood into a larger-than-life horror, albeit one tinged with the vulgarity of exploitation cinema instead of Polanski's wry and artistic touch. Viewing Rocky's experiences through that lens also adds another dimension to her relationship with the blind man. They are both parents, and they're both convinced anything can be justified if it's on behalf of their child. The difference lies in how they express that conviction. The blind man uses it to fuel violence against others. Rocky uses it to endure the violence committed against herself until she finally gains the upper hand. If that is Rocky's daughter, Don't Breathe deserves some credit not just for its thrills, but also for how well it weaves the theme of parenthood into what would otherwise be a shallow horror narrative. That is a very interesting letter, yes?
That is a very interesting letter. I'm always dubious of the text does not support this, but it would be better if this was true, so I'm going to assume it was true kind of theories.
Yeah.
But this is a really good defense
for
this theory.
Well, it never occurred to me just because she just seems too young to have a kid that old.
Yeah, that was my thinking, too.
But it's great. This whole theory is makes the film so much richer. if true, as they say on the internet.
Yeah, just the concept of them both being parents and both being able to relate in that way to doing something criminal for their child.
Mm-hmm.
It really does make the film more interesting.
It does. Yeah, and that falls apart if they're sisters, doesn't it?
I think Fede Alvarez should go back and recut it with a little subtitle that said, "This girl is her daughter." Just in one scene, just so we know.
I think a little subtle, like overdub dialogue would probably be good.
Hey, my daughter, how are you? Boy, it sure does suck to be in this house where you are abused. I would like to rescue you from it.
The daughter could say, "Mom," right? She's not at that age, though. She's a little younger. So she seems to be like
7 or so, maybe.
She'd be more like, "I love you, Mom."
Aw.
I mean, I haven't seen Don't Breathe, and I wasn't in on that discussion. I'm just butting in here about you guys thinking that Rocky is too young. How old does that character present? Like, I mean, it seems totally feasible that she...
22, 23.
So she could be a teen mother. Like, yeah.
Really? I thought of her as more like maybe 19 or 20, and like the little girl seems to be maybe 7. And that's not biologically impossible, but it really changes the story if she was a mother at like 13 or 14. And it changes the story in ways that should probably be spelled out.
Well, but I will never see the movie to find out for myself, so.
It's only mind-numbingly terrifying, Genevieve. Come on.
We'll show you. Although I did see a picture of Stephen Lang on Twitter last night with his chihuahua and an I'm with her sticker. It is the most adorable thing.
I saw that too.
Retroactively made the movie just a tiny bit less scary, I think.
Well, moving on to our recent Westworld versus Westworld discussion, we got some early feedback from a listener named Matthew.
He writes, in your last episode, you're exploring the context of 1973's Westworld and what it might have to say about what was going on in the culture at the time. You didn't mention it, but right away I thought of the Vietnam War. This movie would have been produced and released during the last few years of America's involvement in Vietnam, and I think there might have been a lot of parallels to explore there. How we overestimated our own capabilities, how we found ourselves fighting an enemy that didn't behave like we thought they should, how we found ourselves in a situation where anyone could be an enemy, and how the only way we survived is through sheer mutual attrition. I think even the choice to focus on the ideal of the old Hollywood Western, complete with an unnecessary barroom brawl, calls to mind how Hollywood sold us on the war using the living embodiment of the Western, John Wayne and the Green Berets. I think that is an interesting thought.
I think our listeners are skunking us on analysis.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I actually had not considered that parallel and probably should, because it's just Vietnam would have been so present in the culture at the time that it was kind of a void not making something about Vietnam and anything with violence in it, at least. But on the other hand, I almost feel like it's like in the early 90s when everything was an AIDS metaphor, you know, mm-hmm. or, yeah. you know, it, almost to the point where you know, any movie whatsoever would be presented as an AIDS metaphor, which probably, you know, somewhat parallel in the sense that it was something that was on people's minds all the time. I think you can see something like Basic Instinct now and not think of it framed in terms of AIDS, but that might just be a matter of forgetfulness, and just not seeing this as a Vietnam parallel might have been a matter of forgetfulness or just not having been alive at the time or conscious at the time on our part as well.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thought, because like once you start looking at that parallel, you start saying things like, oh, well, you know, the quagmire of Vietnam and not being able to get out of it no matter how much we wanted to, and the parallel between that and the idea of like this implacable foe who's kind of alien to you, but it just keeps going long after you think that you should have won, and the only way to win that fight is to retreat. Like, that all seems very apt. At the same time, it's hard to imagine a setting more distanced from the jungles of Vietnam than these incredibly arid landscapes with nothing in them except these, you know, these raw red rocks, like the caverns and the deserts. So, I mean, I'm not certainly not saying that every Vietnam analogy has to take place in the jungle, but I'm certainly not surprised that we didn't make that connection.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that Matthew is suggesting it's a direct metaphor, just that maybe the Vietnam War was informing some of the anxieties that we see in the film. And like we talked a lot about sort of the technological paranoia in that movie, but he's kind of honing in on a different sort of paranoia that is maybe a little more backgrounded, but I think it's still a very plausible influence to cite here.
Well, fair enough. You guys have given us a lot to think about. As always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll bring in American Honey, a journey across the American heartland with a British director who is coming to know the landscape for the first time. It's a story about life on the road made by a cast and crew who actually lived on the road and who, as the soundtrack keeps reminding us, found love in a hopeless place. Okay, sort of. Like everything else in American Honey, it's a pretty troubled love, but we'll get into that soon enough. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, and follow us on Twitter at @nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we're going to make this recording studio a little more immaculate with our Dutch boy cleanser and our scrub brushes. Stand by.